Decades ago, peregrine falcons all but disappeared from Pennsylvania because of a pesticide. But now, through the work of conservationists and volunteers, they're roaring back.
When people get themselves educated and involved, people can solve environmental problems.
I'm Kara Holsapel. This week on the Allegheny Front, the lessons of the peregrine falcon. And landowners in Pennsylvania are also stepping up to help wildlife by improving habitat and saving their forest land from development.
I said, at least when we're dead and gone, nobody can do it. So now it stays like this forever.
Plus, toxic chemicals from firefighting foam have been found at 2 military bases in southwestern Pennsylvania.
They don't ever disappear. So if they're getting into the groundwater there, they're staying there unless someone does something to get rid of them.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. The Pennsylvania Attorney General's office is investigating the disposal of contaminated water from a landfill that accepts fracking waste at a sewage treatment plant in Fayette County. The investigation comes after a judge barred the Westmoreland Sanitary Landfill from sending its wastewater to the Bell Vernon Waste Treatment Plant for 90 days. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier has more.
Beginning last spring, the treatment plant started seeing levels of pollution in its discharge to the Monongahela River go up and over state and federal limits. It determined the contamination was coming from the landfill, which accepts fracking waste like drill cuttings and sends the sewage plant its leachate. That's water that's percolated through the landfill and is collected for disposal. District attorneys from Fayette and Washington counties got a judge to issue a 90-day injunction against the landfill to stop sending its leachate to the treatment plant. Then Rich Bauer, the Fayette County District Attorney, says they referred the case to the Attorney General.
What we're doing when you do that is that you're asking them to determine whether or not there is any criminal activity that they're going to be able to investigate and to prosecute.
A spokeswoman for the landfill says it's currently using, quote, approved alternatives for disposal. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
After months of Democratic Governor Tom Wolf promoting a sweeping infrastructure plan funded by a tax on natural gas drillers in Pennsylvania, some Senate Republicans have come up with an alternative. WITF's Katie Meyer reports they want to expand drilling in state forests.
The Senate proposal comes from Republicans Cameron Bartolotta and Pat Stefano of Beaver and Fayette counties, respectively. They say they can raise about $1 billion annually for things like parks and flood control by lifting Wolf's moratorium on new gas drillers leasing state land. Pennsylvania's state forests were once largely wiped out. Now, the state manages about 2.2 million forested acres, and a large portion is already open to drillers. Bartolotta says she doesn't think more drilling would be invasive.
This is in no way putting a drilling rig in the middle of a forest. 3 miles away, these things can be done, and it's 6,000 feet underground.
Conservationists have raised concerns that even non-surface drilling damages habitats and can introduce invasive species. Wolf's plan would hypothetically raise $4.5 billion. His spokesman says the Senate plan doesn't do enough, but his call for a severance tax is a non-starter among Republicans. Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
A nonprofit that works to protect the Chesapeake Bay says Pennsylvania is lagging behind in efforts to curb polluted runoff that harms the nation's largest estuary. A new report from the Chesapeake Bay Foundation faults the state for not investing enough to support farmers' efforts to limit their runoff. Harry Campbell is the executive director of the foundation's Pennsylvania office.
Demonstrable scientific improvement is occurring not only in the Chesapeake Bay, but also in the rivers and streams that feed into it, like the Susquehanna. The pace of implementation, the pace of improvement has not kept up.
The foundation says Pennsylvania's plan to reach goals to reduce pollution, which were set by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, would only account for about two-thirds of the runoff. The State Department of Environmental Protection says best management practices in place across the state are not getting credit. It says the plan provides reasonable assurance that Pennsylvania will meet its Chesapeake Bay commitments. At Presque Isle on Lake Erie, an invasive turtle species known as the red-eared slider is making itself at home. 90.5 WESA's Amy Sisk reports that a new project seeks to keep their population under control.
No one knows exactly how many red-eared sliders live at Presque Isle, but they show up when pet owners release the animals after they're no longer wanted. The turtles can live 30 years. Sarah Stallman is with the Coastal Education Program, Pennsylvania Sea Grant.
They think, oh, you know, this is a turtle. It can go into the wild. Everything's okay, and this is the right thing to do. But then the turtle ends up having very significant negative impacts to the environment and the ecosystem.
The red-eared slider can take away food and habitat from species native to Presque Isle, some of which are threatened. Pennsylvania Sea Grant is setting out traps for the turtles and has captured six since last fall. Stallman says families that no longer want their turtles should contact a local pet store to see if it will take the animals, or look for an aquarium club or reptile rescue. Releasing turtles into the wild is illegal in Pennsylvania. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Amy Sisk.
Across the street from the Amtrak station, in the busiest part of downtown Harrisburg, stands the Rachel Carson State Office Building. It's named for the famous environmentalist and home to the Department of Environmental Protection. It's also home to some famous falcons. WITF's Katie Meyer reports Carson herself would probably be thrilled to know the birds are still here.
If you want to get a young peregrine falcon out of its nest without its parents beating you with their wings, you're gonna need a broom.
There we go.
Hi, little guys. You ready for some fun? We're gonna go for a little ride.
At least, that's the approach Art McMorris and several other State Game Commission biologists take. Every year, they put on harnesses, hard hats, and goggles and shimmy onto an office building ledge 15 stories up. Their goal is straightforward. Gently grab the nestlings and stick them in cardboard boxes so they can be banded and tracked. Well, that and avoiding the parents. The broom is the distraction, so they'll dive bomb it instead of the biologist's heads. It works most of the time.
We're not hurting their young. We're not hurting them, but of course they don't know that, so they will be flying around trying to whack us. It has happened. It has happened.
Okay, so what do we have? Oh, okay, I can tell just by looking that this is a female. She's a big girl.
McMorris is the Game Commission's Peregrine Falcon Program Coordinator. He's been banding and tracking the Rachel Carson Falcons since he started working at the agency in 2004. The birds have been here a little longer than that. A pair first landed on the 15th floor ledge in 1997, but didn't produce any chicks. Another pair gave the spot a shot 3 years later, and it has been occupied ever since. Falcons mate long-term and are strongly attached to their territory. Enthusiasts have gotten to know the birds' personalities like their old friends, thanks to a live stream from the cameras around the ledge. Thousands of people watch, and some go a step further.
For day shift, I'll get here very early in the morning, and then I usually have to come in and work a little bit. Then I might go in, or you know, I'll run out with the walkie-talkie if they call me, and then after work we'll be out there. And there's actually like a night shift then, and that's usually.
Renee Larry, a Department of Environmental Protection worker with a falcon tattoo on her chest, is one of Harrisburg's more active falcon watchers. Young urban falcons have high mortality rates, especially in the first few weeks they learn to fly. Larry and a small group of dedicated bird watchers try to keep them out of trouble.
Yeah, and I had to stop the cars and throw my jacket over it and get it and save it. That was like my most memorable one. Last year, a red girl was on top of Strawberry Square there on the glass. We had to get her down.
Just green different. Girl was the most memorable for
oh,
me.
Oh, on the train station.
Once they get through that touch-and-go period, the Rachel Carson Falcons scatter, often across the Northeast, Midwest, and Canada.
There's a bird that flies over these roofs that finds its prey not on the ground, but in the air. And it owes its success to its speed. In fact, it's said to be the fastest moving animal on Earth, the peregrine.
When they reach adulthood, peregrines thrive in cities. As of 2013, there were around 40 known nests in Pennsylvania, some on the cliffs falcons naturally favor, and many on buildings and bridges. But just a few decades ago, so many healthy pairs would have been unthinkable.
for this new insect destroyer contains a lot of DDT, not just a little. Its DDT content is even higher than government specifications.
That's because of DDT. The pesticide became ubiquitous in the 1940s. Planes sprayed it liberally over crops, and people doused their houses, pets, and children in it. And then, birds started dying. DDT wasn't good for adult animals, but in large predatory birds, its impact was especially profound when it came to eggs, weakening and cracking shells before they could hatch. According to the Game Commission, peregrine falcon nests disappeared from Pennsylvania around 1959. That's where the namesake of the Rachel Carson Building comes into all this. Biologist Rachel Carson's 1962 book, The Silent Spring, painted a picture of a world plagued by illness, where people and animals suddenly fall sick and where fish and birds slowly disappear. It became a bestseller and helped galvanize resistance to indiscriminate pesticide use. DDT is now heavily regulated, and Pennsylvania's peregrines are well on their way to recovery. Cindy Adams-Dunn, who heads the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, says it's a lesson for environmentalists working on the issues of today, like climate change.
That is, even though environmental issues may seem insurmountable, when people decide they're going to solve them and take proactive actions and have appropriate regulations and get themselves educated and involved, people can solve environmental problems.
I think. And now I'll show you one of the babies.
The department's trying to keep that lesson alive through the falcons on the Rachel Carson Building. After Art McMorris got this year's four chicks off the 15th floor ledge, he brought three downstairs for a Q&A with some fifth graders, many of whom are in their school's birding club.
What is the average lifespan of a falcon?
That's a very good question.
All of this year's falcon chicks are healthy. Soon they'll start learning to fly. And even though it's one of the more treacherous times in their lives, falcon watcher Sue Hannon says it's also the most exciting.
It's like, this is Christmas for me. I look forward to it that much.
The young falcons will hang around Harrisburg for a little while. And then if all goes well, they'll fly away. The newest representatives of a species that finally has a future. Katie Meyer in Harrisburg.
Most forests are privately owned in Pennsylvania. It's up to the landowners to decide how to use them. And some are choosing conservation easements.
I looked at my wife one day and I said, are we ever going to put any buildings? We're never going to develop this. She's like, heck no. And I'm like, then why not just put it in this program?
Later on the Allegheny Front, how landowners are ensuring that their forests will stay green for wildlife, now and in the future. A U.S. National Guard report out last fall found that toxic firefighting foam has contaminated the surface and groundwater at two military bases in southwestern Pennsylvania. The sites are located near the Pittsburgh International Airport, and Oliver Morrison, a reporter with Public Source, has been writing about the chemicals found there, known as PFAS. Hi, Oliver.
Hi.
So we've talked about PFAS chemicals here on the show before, but can you just briefly explain what they are and what they're used for?
PFAS chemicals have been used in a lot of industrial products. The thing that they're really good at is they're good at repelling oil and water. So that means they're put in like furniture and clothing that they want to be water repellent, or cookingware, things like that. But the big place that has become a real big problem across the U.S. is in firefighting foam, especially for these airports and military bases, because this foam was really good at putting out these dangerous fires that had lots of oil and gas on them because it repelled both. But we've since learned that it causes toxic contamination.
Yeah, so your most recent story is about a new report that came out actually last fall from the U.S. National Guard, as you say, with very little fanfare, which found that toxic firefighting foam has contaminated the surface and groundwater at two military bases. Can you just help us understand how this foam was managed in the first place?
A little of this is still a bit unknown. So some parts of the report where they investigated and they looked into the history of the foam would say, we used to test the foam off in the forest. We don't know exactly where or how much. But what we do know is that they have kept some detailed reports on spills, for example. And so sometimes they have these planes in their hangars and they have these elaborate firefighting systems set up. And sometimes those firefighting systems would get set off on accident, and the foam would start spilling everywhere, oftentimes into creeks or onto the base, down into the stormwater, things like that.
Well, you write that the report indicates that surface and groundwater at the site sampled on these two bases was contaminated with PFAS chemicals at levels above the threshold for safe drinking water. Those are set by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. So how can groundwater and surface water impact drinking water for people living near these sites?
One of the big risks that's hinted at in the report, but they don't answer because they didn't test off the base, they only tested on base, is that 4 miles away by groundwater, there's a municipal authority, the Moon Township Municipal Authority, that has wells that are down gradient of one of the bases. And the worry would be that over time, it's unclear depending on the specific geology and hydrology, that these chemicals will migrate into that water authority.
And that could happen over months, years, decades?
Yeah, we don't know. It really depends on the specifics. We'd have to hire a local hydrologist or geologist to sort of be able to help you answer that question.
In your reporting, John Riley, the general manager of the Moon Township Municipal Authority, which is the water authority in that area, public water authority, you know, kind of worries that this report is going to make people worried when they don't need to be worried about their drinking water. He says that the military bases are miles downriver from where the authority's source is for drinking water. What do you say to that?
I think it's a really important point for people to take in right now that might get scared by a big headline like this, is that they just recently did test their water after we came out with an article in December, and the water showed that it is safe to drink. So it doesn't appear that anyone is at risk of drinking the Moon Township water right now. Some scientists are concerned that at some point down the future that there could be a problem still. And one of the reasons is that when they tested the water showing it was safe, they tested it after it had already been treated through a process called carbon filtration, which is supposed to take out these PFAS chemicals. And so we know that it's safe after it's been treated, but we don't know yet like what kind of contamination there might be in the water already. And so if they were to make a mistake or if it wasn't being kept up properly, then potentially people could be at risk. One of the things I heard from scientists is that it can be more complicated with PFAS chemicals, that the carbon filters sometimes wear out a little bit faster. And so what he recommended is that water authorities like this be testing regularly for these PFAS chemicals to make sure that the carbon filtration is working. And that's not something that the Moon Township Municipal Authority is doing yet.
The Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection has been testing public drinking water systems for PFAS contamination, but not private wells. How do these sites fit into DEP's statewide testing and the governor's PFAS task force?
Right. So in addition to the water that most of us drink from the tap water, it's typically coming from a city or town that's been treated in a big way and it's being tested. There's all these private wells that lots of people across the state are getting their drinking water from. And there are very few regulations or rules for what needs to happen to this water. So that means we know of at least 5 wells near these military bases that have not been tested, and they're not being treated like at the municipal water authority. So it could be that these people have been drinking much more toxic water. Those wells haven't been tested yet.
Is the DEP testing the public drinking water in the area?
We would really love to know the answer to that question. In fact, the way I found this report out was trying to get an answer to that question. I was asking the DEP, are they going to test the water in our area? And they actually told me through that process that, well, actually, we've got this report that shows that there is contamination. And so the DEP is just not saying yet where they're testing. They're looking at the sites that are at most at risk. But we also know that they've identified nearly 500 sites at risk, and right now they only have funding to test about 300 of those sites.
You also reported about potential contamination to streams, including Montour Run, that are nearby these two sites. What's the concern there?
So the concern there is that fish may be getting contaminated with these chemicals. So we know there in the reports, there's lots of examples of, or at least several examples, when this toxic firefighting foam has been getting into these streams. Now, the issue with fish is that if they're spending years in these streams where this contamination is happening, they could be slowly accumulating it more and more into their flesh. In certain states like New Jersey, Minnesota, what they've done is they've set limits for the kinds of fish and the amount of fish people can eat in areas that are known to have PFAS contamination, because they worry that you'll just get this really big dose of contamination eating one or two of these fish that you wouldn't get from drinking a smaller amount of water.
Yeah, the report talks about spills that have happened in the 90s and also I think one from 2013, which is several years ago. So I'm just wondering, wouldn't the PFAS contamination have moved through the watershed? I guess maybe I don't understand where the PFAS is being stored? Is it stored in the riverbed?
That's a good question. We asked if anyone has tested the water in or around, and no one's done any testing yet like that. So we don't know exactly what the answer would be. We do know that these chemicals, because of their really strong fluoride bonds, they don't ever disappear. So if they're getting into the groundwater there, if they're getting into the rocks or the ground near these rivers, they're staying there unless someone does something to get rid of them.
What is the military saying about this report and cleaning up the contamination? Is this contamination ongoing?
So the recommendations of the report are that they need to find out how far the contamination has spread. And so that's one of the things they're saying within the report itself. They aren't saying a lot specifically to this report in general, but one of the big questions right now is about how this is going to get paid for, because there's contamination at these bases all across the country, and some local townships, like in eastern Pennsylvania, are having to pay right now for their own water to be cleaned up, or they're having to pay some of these costs on their own. And so some people are hoping that the military will step up, or that Congress will pass legislation that will provide funding for some of this cleanup to happen.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to your continuing reporting on this.
All right, thanks so much.
Oliver Morrison is the environment and health reporter at Public Source. And there's more on their collaborative reporting project about PFAS chemicals with Environmental Health News. That's at publicsource.org. You're listening to The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Bats and songbirds are in trouble in Pennsylvania. So the government has turned to private landowners to protect their habitat. More than 70% of land in Pennsylvania is privately owned. Each year, about 400 landowners manage their property for threatened and endangered species. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant visited one family last spring in Blair County. And here's their story.
To find Tom Belinda's house in Williamsburg near Altoona, you wind through a small community of homes and fields along the river valley and up a nearly 2-mile-long gravel driveway. Finally, the woods break open to a clearing and a mountain lodge home that's made of logs. After a wet greeting from two black Newfoundlands,
this one might lick you to death.
Belinda leads me to the second-story deck, which looks out over his 1,300-acre wooded valley.
Yep, I never want to leave the mountain, man. I'll tell you.
He's a forester and a hunter, wearing a ball cap and camouflage pants, and he quickly spots deer in the distance.
See him walking in the woods to the left?
Oh, yeah. I see.
There's three of them. There's another little one.
Belinda and his wife bought this property 20 years ago when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service contacted him about managing his land to improve habitat for endangered Indiana bats. He laughed. He points to the eaves under his roof. He was already providing them habitat.
And I'm like, yeah, you guys want me to manage all this stuff for the woods. And I said, you can just come up underneath my poles of my house and I can show them right where they're at it every day.
But as he looked into it, Belinda says managing his land for bat habitat made sense. He's surrounded by state game lands and other private property, much of it part of a corridor of nearly 21,000 acres of protected bat habitat. And then there's the bat cave. He points out from his deck at the cave where these tiny mouse-eared bats, weighing as little as 3 pennies, hibernate in the winter.
Which you can see over there past that red topped house, there's Canoe Creek Lake over there, and there's an actual well-known bat hibernacula that where they go in the wintertime.
According to the Natural Resources Conservation Service, a branch of the USDA, a 2015 survey of that bat cave found the number of bats had dropped from 32,000 to just 70. Indiana bats have suffered from habitat loss and white nose syndrome and are listed under the Endangered Species Act. Belinda saw an opportunity to help and to secure the future of his property.
I looked at my wife one day and I said, are we ever going to put any buildings? We're never going to develop this. She's like, heck no. And I'm like, then why not just put it in this program? I said, at least when we're dead and gone, nobody can do it. So now it stays like this for forever.
Belinda put more than half his property into a conservation easement, which means the land can never be developed, even if it's sold. He gets tax breaks for that. He takes me out in a small off-road vehicle to look at how he's managed the land for bats over the past 5 years. We drive down some rocky pathways into the valley to a spot where he's trying to get the trees to grow bigger.
Yep, see, this is the bad area.
In summer, as many as 100 females form colonies in older, larger trees like hickory and ash, where they crawl underneath the warm, shaggy bark to roost. Each raises only one pup a season. This is why Belinda has cleared smaller trees in this area and points to a larger one that remains.
We're going to try to grow it quicker, at a quicker state, quicker than what it normally would. The only way to do that is to remove all the competition.
We head to another spot. In recent years, Belinda has started managing an additional 55 acres specifically for a small blue migratory songbird, the Cerulean warbler. They're known to breed in heavily wooded Appalachian forests. The population of ceruleans dropped 70% over the last 50 years. Belinda is trying to recreate lost cerulean habitat, a mix of large trees and a robust understory. That means creating gaps in the forest canopy to allow sunlight in and smaller plants to grow. We stop along the path on one side.
Look down here. It's all shaded.
The trees are tightly packed together. There's not much growing on the forest floor. Last year, Belinda removed many trees on the other side of this path, making gaps in the overhead tree canopy.
And if you look up through there, this is a nice, beautiful night to see this, because see the sunlight? Every one of those sun holes, those sunbeam holes, is going to grow something.
Belinda wants that sunshine to help the bushes and grapevines grow. They attract insects that ceruleans like. But there's still a problem. Invasive species. Plants like multiflora rose and especially Japanese barberry. These are ornamentals people buy to look pretty in their yards.
This is what it turns into.
We're looking at a thick mass of barberry, a woody shrub covering the forest floor.
Yeah, look, there's nothing can grow. That's all nasty stuff that needs to go.
So Belinda spends a lot of time and money spraying pesticides to get rid of them. The Natural Resources Conservation Service shares his costs. Last year, the agency paid Pennsylvania landowners nearly $250,000 to remove invasives. As the sun goes down, we head back to his house and look out over the deck. One by one, a few small bats slip out from the woodwork and into the night.
There's another one. See it? See, that came out right here.
Belinda says they're headed down the valley toward the river to eat insects. His government partners say efforts by private land stewards like Belinda are giving the bats and warblers a chance to survive in the forests of Pennsylvania. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
That story, which aired last year, was a finalist in the 55th Annual Golden Quill Awards, presented by the Press Club of Western Pennsylvania. Our stories about saw-whet owls and golden-winged warblers were Golden Quill winners. We also took home first place in the statewide AP Managing Editors Awards for our coverage of pipelines, air pollution, and saw-whet owls. See all of our award winners and finalists at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show and podcast, Trump on Earth. All of those episodes are at TrumpOnEarth.org. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. The Sears Sweatland Family Foundation supports our coverage in Ohio. And the Robert F. Schumann Foundation supports our podcast, Trump on Earth. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.